Being 8 o'clock and we have a quorum, call this meeting to order. And first order of business, Representative Albright, did you look at the minutes for February 13th, yesterday's meeting?
Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes from yesterday, February 12th.
Well, February 13th was yesterday. There's two sets. We didn't do yesterday. There was.
Which one would you like to move?
February 13th.
I'll move the minutes from February 13th.
Representative Albright moves the minutes, approval of the minutes for February 13th, 2019. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And now Representative Hewitt. The minutes from the 12th. We didn't do these yesterday because there was a minor tech. There was an error in them, so we fixed that. So, Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes for February 12th.
The minutes for February 12th, approval has been moved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The minutes have been approved for the last two meetings. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Alice Roberts-Davis. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Administration. Thank you for having us here this morning to give an overview of our agency. I'll just start by saying Happy Valentine's Day. Nothing says love like an 8 a.m. hearing on admin. The Department of Administration has a wide range set of responsibilities that ultimately touch every part of state government. You're already familiar with some of our work. Our teams oversaw the restoration of the Capitol. Admin team members clean your offices at night and are here at 3 o'clock in the morning to shovel the sidewalks, and they've been doing that quite a bit this month. They also maintain the beautiful Capitol grounds. There's a lot of work done by the department that you may not be aware of, however. For example, we insure the state's vehicles and property against liability claims, and we negotiate the contracts that allow for low prices based on volume. The diversity of ways in which admin team members serve Minnesotans means that I have a lot of information to share with you today. And as I tell you what we do, I also hope to share with you insight into the reasons why we do what we do. I'll provide an overview of our department and its budget, and then I'll invite a few of my division directors up to do a deeper dive into several key subjects. Since 1939, the Department of Administration has handled state government's core business functions, allowing other agencies to deliver their services directly to Minnesotans. We owe it to our fellow Minnesotans, colleagues, and team members to strive for excellence in all that we do. And so we do that by leading innovation, creating solutions, and providing exceptional service. Our values and goals are based on the principles of diversity and inclusion, customer satisfaction, and technology modernization, just to name a few. Admin's duty is to help government best serve Minnesotans. We do that through behind-the-scenes business functions that provide both the administrative backbone for public agencies and direct service to residents. For example, our work allows the Department of Education to focus on educating our children rather than managing their purchasing, as well as citizens in Moorhead to understand their rights as it relates to government information. We are a diverse agency with a wide-ranging portfolio of responsibilities, team members, and diverse expertise and skill sets with a very complex budget. Here is a snapshot of what we do and the diversity of the work that we do. Admin has 544 team members and 24 divisions that oversee $2.3 billion in purchasing, more than 800 leases across the state. We manage 400 construction projects annually, and we operate a fleet of more than 2,000 vehicles. Some brief facts about our 544 team members. 131 of them are eligible to retire within the next 2 years. And 18 staff retired in the fiscal year last year, and we've already had 10 staff retire in the first 6 months of FY19. So I say all that to say that we have a lot of great experience that's going out the door, and it's going to be a significant HR challenge for us to maintain our great team and the level of service that we currently provide. Admin's budget is a mix of legislatively appropriated general fund, internal service and special revenue fund, and federal grants. The rates and budgets that are included in the Special Revenue Fund and Internal Service Funds are proposed in 9 business plans that are reviewed and approved by MMB annually. The difference between the two for admin are that a special revenue fund is generally revenue from transactions between private entities and state agencies, for example, the parking fund, in which parkers pay for the maintenance and operation of state parking facilities. An internal service fund is transactions between agencies, such as the $27 million in property and casualty insurance premiums paid to the department's risk management division. Four admin programs are funded by federal grants. We have the Developmental Disabilities Council, Assistive Technology for Persons with Disabilities, or the STAR program, the Procurement Technical Assistance Center, or PTAC, and the State Historic Preservation Office, which is SHPO. I'd like to now go into a little more detail on the department's general fund budget. The general fund operating budget is dispersed across 15 divisions. It makes up about 12% of admin's budget, but that's a little bit misleading because half of that is legislatively appropriated pass-through funds, such as in lieu of rent, grant funding to public television and radio stations, and it also includes two open forecasted appropriations, one for $937,000 for tax credits and grants for historic preservation projects through SHPO, and another for almost $700,000 for workers' compensation reinsurance premiums. So, in fact, our actual general fund operating budget is only 6% of admin's total budget. Although it's small, it is a really critical component to providing the breadth and the quality of our enterprise services. I'd now like to give you a high-level overview of admin's divisions. So first is the Facilities Management Division, and these are the people who you are most likely to see regularly as they clean your offices, repair this building, and show up at all hours to shovel snow. They maintain and operate 23 state-owned buildings, including the state capitol, plus 32 parking facilities, 25 monuments, and associated grounds for a total of 4.4 million square feet. This division also coordinates events on the Capitol complex and oversees the administration of Minnesota's bookstore, the State Register, and Central Mail. Central Mail provides mailing services to Minnesota state agencies, processing mail by zip sorting and automation. Minnesota's bookstore operates as a centralized publishing house for state agency products sold to the public, such as building codes, state statutes and rules, as well as hunting, lakes, and river maps. And then finally, the Minnesota State Register is the official publication of the state of Minnesota's executive branch of government. It's published weekly, and it provides notice of rules, hearings, bids, and other legislatively mandated materials. Admin also oversees the construction and leasing of buildings across all state government. Real Estate and Construction Services, or RECS, manages more than 400 construction projects and administers 800 property leases annually. RECS has 313 construction projects going on now, plus 108 projects that are in warranty phase. Our project managers are extremely busy, and on average, each one manages 31 construction projects at any given time. The Department of Administration also created a green lease program in 2016. The program has initiated more than 149 negotiated leases in which private sector facility owners have agreed to meet criteria to improve the environmental footprint of state government space. One example of this is the Minnesota Housing Finance new office space in the Treasure Island Center in the old Dayton store in downtown St. Paul. They formerly officed in an older building spread out over five floors. And in their new offices, they're in a contiguous area. The space is heated and cooled by St. Paul's District Energy, and its fixtures are modern, employing energy-saving standards. In addition to overseeing construction and repairs, admin coordinates data collection and management for enterprise property management. The Enterprise Real Property Program is a team of just two who manage 19 state agencies that have custodial ownership of real property. This team has trained each agency on a consistent way to assess properties so that we have a common language to describe the condition of buildings and prioritize maintenance needs across the enterprise. This assessment process is how we've determined that the state's need for $850 million to catch up on deferred building maintenance exists. Overall, the state has a real property footprint that includes roughly 6,100 buildings, 36.8 million square feet of owned property, and 3.7 million square feet of leased property. The Enterprise Real Property Program Manager is responsible for directing the state's enterprise real property efforts to meet state agencies' business needs and ensure the state's Archibus system, which is our enterprise database, and other system tools are maximized to meet enterprise objectives. The government structure for ERP was formed to provide a transparent, results-oriented collaboration responsible for and knowledgeable about facilities management. The team analyzes common facility information to make effective enterprise management decisions. They set and monitor standards and performance goals for enterprise real property, and they maximize state resources to support property management. In sum, this program allows us and you to make data-driven decisions around facilities. Wayne Wislowski will share more about this program later in this presentation this morning. In addition to facilities, we provide contracts for the goods and services that agencies need to fulfill their missions. The Office of State Procurement oversees more than $2 billion in purchasing of goods and services annually. The division negotiates low pricing based on volume purchasing and manages about 1,600 enterprise contracts at any given time. Within the Office of State Procurement, the Office of Equity and Procurement helps ensure greater access to contracting. They work with business owners who are women, minorities, veterans, people with substantial physical disabilities, and those who live in economically disadvantaged areas of the state to assist them in bidding on state contracts. This office was established in 2015, and by 2018, we saw an increase in spend with Black-owned businesses of 2,000% and Indigenous-owned businesses of 1,500%. The Procurement Technical Assistance Center is partially federally funded, and it provides one-on-one counseling to Minnesota businesses interested in contracting with the federal, state, or local government. They also conduct and attend more than 75 outreach events each year to educate businesses on how to compete for government contracts. In addition, the Office of State Procurement leads the two largest multi-state cooperative purchasing programs in the nation. One is MCAP, which negotiates contracts for pharmaceuticals, and the other is our own cooperative, which allows more than 1,300 of Minnesota's cities, counties, and school districts to benefit from the state's low negotiated pricing. The Office of Enterprise Sustainability was established in 2016 to provide leadership and continuity across state government to reduce the carbon footprint of the state. In 2018, the office produced its inaugural sustainability report. This report was the result of gathering and analyzing more than 1.5 million data points. This information in this report will serve as the baseline for each agency as they work toward goals of reducing the state's carbon footprint. The office will continue to provide guidance and resources to assist the agencies in this work. Marcus Grubbs and Jordan Wente from the office are here, and they will share the great story about this office and the work that they're doing, the leadership they're providing, and the relationships with both the public and private sectors a little later in our presentation. Another part of admin's portfolio is transportation services and property management. Fleet Services leases vehicles to state agencies for official state business. The division's lease program manages vehicle acquisition and disposition, fueling, maintenance, auto insurance, and lifecycle management for roughly 2,100 vehicles. Surplus Services assists with the redistribution, reuse, and disposal of state and surplus property. Property is redistributed to state and local governments, nonprofit, health, and educational organizations, programs for low-income, needy, and persons experiencing homelessness, just to name a few of the service groups. Did you know that Admin is the state's insurance agent? Risk management also serves the needs of state employees and agencies through full-service workers' compensation insurance, including disability management, return to work, and legal services. They also provide safety, loss control, risk, and insurance management consulting services to state agencies. One example of loss control is MinSafe. The Minnesota Safety Accountability for Everyone is a statewide workplace safety initiative for all employees of the state of Minnesota. At Admin, we are focused on helping state government reduce the number of employees injured on the job. Between 2012 and 2014, agencies reduced workplace injuries by 23%. The current injury reduction goal is 5% annually. We have several very small business units that have an outsized impact on state services. The Small Agency Resource Team, or SMART, provides accounting, budgeting, and human resources services to 18 small agencies, boards, and councils. These are very small operations, and SMART services assist them by navigating the complexities of the state systems, which allows them to focus on their individual missions. The Office of Grants Management works in partnership with more than 30 state agencies and organizations to standardize, streamline, and improve state government grant-making practices and increase public information about state grant opportunities. OGM administers general fund grants to public broadcasting that support a variety of things, including equipment and Amber Alert infrastructure for the state of Minnesota. They also administer more than $20 million in arts and cultural heritage grants to 37 grantees, including public television, as well as a number of zoos, museums, veterans memorials, and others. Continuous improvement provides project leadership, training, and improvement tools to all cabinet-level agencies, regardless of their budget, because these services are free. They have no need to hire expensive external consultants to fix a problem. Our team can help them. And finally, the Data Practices Office provides informal advice and technical assistance to government, public, media, and legislature who have questions about data practices and open meeting law. We also have key responsibilities in protecting Minnesota's heritage. Archaeology assists state agencies and other government entities, professionals, students, and the general public with site protection, education, and research. SHPO plays a lead role in identifying, evaluating, and registering historic properties, administering federal and state historic rehabilitation tax credits, consulting with federal and state agencies to ensure historic properties are taken into consideration at all levels of planning and development, and advising and assisting federal and state agencies and local governments in carrying out their preservation responsibilities. SHPO is also responsible for creating and implementing a comprehensive statewide historic preservation plan. I'd like to highlight three programs that are instrumental in providing information and services to the public. The first is the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, which works to assure that persons with developmental disabilities receive the necessary support to achieve increased independence, self-determination, productivity, and integration into the community. Some of your constituents have likely participated in the nationally and internationally recognized Partners in Policymaking program, which teaches those with disabilities and their families about advocacy for their rights. You'll hear momentarily from the state demographer, Susan Brower. The State Demographic Center analyzes and interprets demographic data and shares it with the public. They are also Minnesota's official liaison with the U.S. Census Bureau for Census 2020. And then finally, the System of Technology to Achieve Results, or STAR, helps all Minnesotans with disabilities gain access to and acquire the assistive technology they need to live, learn, work, and play. Assistive technology helps people of all ages with disabilities, including older adults with functional needs, increase and maintain, improve independence at home, school, work, and in their communities. Since 2013, STAR has provided nearly 900 Minnesotans with disabilities with free use of assistive technology, saving these individuals nearly $2 million while they tried different products before actually purchasing them. The Minnesota STAR program is federally funded. So that concludes the general overview, and I would like to invite a few of my colleagues to provide more in-depth information on several key issues. I'd like to note that our state demographer, Susan Brower, is going to be first, but she's got to make it to another appointment, so she'll be speaking fairly briefly.
And members, because she has to leave quickly, let's hold all our questions till the end, but if you have specific questions for the demographer's office, we'll take those after she's done so, because she's got to leave shortly after she gives her presentation. So I think there are two people on the list. Are they for admin or specific for this, for the demographer? Okay. And Representative Vogel, is yours?
Admin.
Okay, we'll hold yours till the end then. Welcome to the committee, and long time no see.
Yes, that's right.
I was at a meeting last night with her.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Susan Brower. I'm the state demographer. I work in the Community Services Division of the Department of Administration. So our office, the State Demographic Center, is small. We average five FTEs. And our primary purpose...
Can you move the mic a little bit closer?
How's this?
That's great. Yeah.
Our primary purpose is to produce and analyze demographic data and make it available to state leaders and to the public. We work closely with the Census Bureau throughout the decade, but especially as the decennial census nears. And through a variety of partnership programs with the Bureau, we work to make sure that the data coming out of the Bureau for the state of Minnesota is accurate and complete, and it is produced in a way that's useful to our stakeholders. We also analyze data to shed light on a number of demographic trends, such as urban and rural changes, immigration, labor force, aging, social and economic kinds of trends, and differences between groups. And we disseminate our findings through written research reports and through presentations to thousands of public, private, and nonprofit leaders and stakeholders throughout the year. We also provide customized data analysis for state agencies to the extent that we're able to do that. And we point people in the direction of the demographic data that they're looking for through our demography helpline. So there are a number of data sets that we produce, thank you, in-house. We create annual population estimates, which is just the total number of people for all counties, cities, and townships, 2,500 of them outside of the 7-county metropolitan area. Local governments use these numbers, and also it's used to distribute LGA funds. We produce annual data that helps Minnesotans look to the future as well. We publish updated population projections each year, and these are used by leaders in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors to anticipate changes that will impact policies and programs. Our projections are also used to guide public and private investments. For example, they're used as an input to the state budget forecast, and they're used to estimate the increase longer term in Medicaid enrollment, what the cost of that will be to the state. So for much of the decade, the years ending in 1 through 7, we are laser focused on demographic analysis and data. And then as the decennial census begins to near around the years ending in 8 to 0, we start looking to what we can do to support the important work of the Census Bureau in the state of Minnesota. There's a lot at stake for Minnesota each decade when a federal census is taken. Census data are used to apportion congressional representation to Minnesota. They're the basis, of course, for state legislative districts. And they are used to distribute billions of dollars of federal funds to Minnesota and its communities each year. Minnesota government, businesses, and nonprofit leaders use the census data to decide how to fairly and efficiently distribute funds and make investments in Minnesota. It's really hard to overstate the importance of the census. It really serves as the foundation for political representation and for the way that we distribute public funds fairly and efficiently to the community. But to make this a little bit more concrete, there's been a recent study by George Washington University that looks specifically at the money that's distributed to Minnesota on the basis of the decennial census count. It comes out to about $8 billion per year just for the 16 largest federal programs, and that is in a number of different areas, from Medicare to transportation, infrastructure, housing, education, energy assistance. It works out to about $1,500 per person per year, or if you look at that over the course of the decade, that's $15,000 combined over the course of the decade. So our office, thank you, our office supports the work of the Census Bureau on the decennial census by making sure that the Bureau has the data that it needs to be able to take an accurate census. We help with checking address lists to make sure that the Census Bureau has a complete and accurate list of all households, all places where people are living throughout the state. And we encourage local governments to do the same for their jurisdictions. We also make sure that the Census Bureau has the very latest information on where people live together in groups, such as in college dorms, prisons, in nursing homes, homeless shelters. And so in this way, we provide kind of the technical and data assistance to the Bureau as they go into this huge undertaking of the decennial census. We also do a lot of work to make sure that counties and cities are ready to promote the census in their local communities. In 2020, it's going to be a big challenge to get an accurate census. That's not just here in Minnesota, that's everywhere. And our office is working to make sure that the people know, the people of Minnesota know what the census is, they know kind of what its importance is, and what they need to do to be able to fill out their census forms. We do this through a number of different kinds of programs and partnerships. We support the work of the State Complete Count Committee. We support work with county and local governments who have their own complete count committees, which are voluntary committees that are aimed at promoting the 2020 census. And then we work with advocacy and nonprofit and grant-making members of the community who are also focused on the 2020 census. And with that, I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, I have a few questions here. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of reporting on some of the challenges that the federal census program is having and some of the underfunding there. Curious, you talked about how your role changes quite a bit in years 8, 9, and 0. Do you think we would have a better chance of keeping our Minnesota congressional seat if there were some additional one-time resources to help support an accurate count?
Ms. Bowers.
Mr. Chair, Representative. There are a lot of challenges facing this census. I think it's going to be a difficult one to take, and it's very, very close in our estimation and others in terms of whether or not we'll be able to keep that 8th congressional district. In 2010, we kept it. We were the very last state to receive a seat. We kept it by about 8,000 people. And so this time around, we're in the very same position. The estimates now are that we are somewhere around 10 to 30,000, kind of over that, around hovering around that line of keeping a seat or losing a seat. I can say that the Census Bureau, because it's been underfunded up until now, they're kind of coming from behind. They're running to keep up. In our interactions with them, you can see that they're good people, but they're struggling very hard to try to get things in place to do this. And so I think anything that the state can do to support the work of the census will indeed help make sure that we have an accurate count, and that's what we're committed to doing.
And Ms. Browers, as I'm looking at the graphic that's up there, the state receives $8 billion. So if we can extrapolate that, if we lost a seat, that would be $7 billion, $1 billion approximately per.
Mr. Chair, these numbers that you see here are showing the impact of the federal formulas using census data. So they don't directly correlate with the apportionment of seats. What we would lose is political representation that can be quantified as, if right now when we split the state up into 8 equal pieces, if we were to now split it up into 7, we would grow our districts by about 100,000 additional people. So we would be losing kind of that representation, and we would also be losing the Electoral College votes.
Representative Long, do you have another question?
Thank you.
Vogel, Representative Vogel, you wanted for the admin. Okay. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. And just to make sure, it sounds like there are more problems with this upcoming census than previous years? And is it just a matter of money, and is it a matter of money in Minnesota or nationally?
Ms. Browers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are more problems with this census, I believe, than past censuses. It's always really hard to take a census, but especially this time around. I don't think it's unique to Minnesota. We tend to do fairly well with censuses if we compare ourselves to the rest of the U.S., but I think that this time around there are a number of specific challenges that I think are going to be really important that we address in the next year that we have to address them.
Can you elaborate, Mr. Chair, Ms. Brower, can you elaborate some of those problems?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Ms. Browers.
So there are a number of things that are ongoing just in the U.S. That makes taking a census harder than normal. We tend to be more mobile than we have in the past. We have complex households that are difficult to account for when we're counting people. One example of that is if you think about kind of non-traditional family structures, if you think about kids who are moving in between parents' houses, they tend to get missed just because there's some question about where they might be counted. So there are things like that that are going on kind of long term. In addition to that, there's declining response rates to surveys. People are tired of surveys. They get them almost at every website that they go to and every fast food restaurant that they go to. They're tired of it. So the Census Bureau faces that as an ongoing challenge as well. And then the lack of funding so far with the Census Bureau really is going to be a problem in that they're having a really hard time catching up to where they should be at this point in the decade. The fact that we have a really strong economy is fantastic for us right now, but when there are 7,500 additional census jobs that are plunked down on top of the openings that we already have, it's going to be a huge challenge to try to find people who are available and willing to actually do the work of the census in Minnesota. So I think these are and then finally, you know, the growing distrust of government, particularly the addition of a citizenship question, which I think causes a lot of fear for people in answering the question. That question may or may not be removed, but I think that's another kind of major obstacle to taking a complete census, is to have a question on the form that is sensitive to folks and that makes people afraid to answer their census form.
Representative Mason.
Thank you. Last question. You are probably the last member of the State Planning Agency. Is there any planning responsibilities that you have or that are taking place within the agency?
Ms. Browers.
Mr. Chair, Representative. There's a strategic planning report that's produced every 5 years that we're involved in. The last time that it was produced was in 2015, if I'm recalling correctly, and we do play a role in that. Our role is to help anticipate some of the long-term changes that we'll see as a result of the demographic shifts that we are projecting.
Thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rauer, I come here from 8 years on the Metropolitan Council, where I've been an avid consumer of the work of the council's demographers, Libby Starling, Todd Graham, and that team. I was wondered if there is somewhere, especially as you get later into the decennial process, if you get together with them to do any kind of truing up of the forecast where they overlap at particular levels of granularity.
Ms. Browers.
Mr. Chair, Representative. We work really closely with the Metropolitan Council in the decennial census in particular. They're helping us with some of the technical things that I talked about in terms of the address listing. Mm-hmm. And we also work with them around outreach for the 2020 census. In terms of projections, mm-hmm. We have worked with them in the past. We tend to come at projections from a different model, a different background, and for me, I think that's a good thing because we have a diversity of perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Representative Elkin. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I find it confusing the return of a question would cause so much consternation. But my question is, I'd like to see the delta analysis between, I'm assuming your office looks at its last estimation, looks at the census, and does a delta analysis. I'm interested in looking at that and understanding, because there were several communities that saw a large decrease between the estimate and the census, and some of those communities actually had physical growth, you know, building permits, etc. The schools saw increase in enrollments, and so I'm just, that might be useful to understand some of the dynamics.
Ms. Browers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have data that guide where we expect it will be difficult to count folks based on the characteristics that we know are correlated with an undercount. The Census Bureau does some work after a census to try to come up with an estimate of that undercount. Typically, it does so at the state level, so we don't have very granular data. What I can say is, when we have higher self-participation rates by community members, that's when we tend to get a more accurate and complete count. And so we're trying to come at this from, with the foresight of past censuses, kind of knowing who might be harder to count, who might be more likely to miss, and hopefully be able to address some of those issues that have come up in the past. But I can say that there's not specific granular data that would allow us to point out exactly what that delta might be.
Forgive my anecdotal getting in front of the actual intent. The intent was it's a great opportunity every 10 years to improve your techniques for doing your annual estimates. And I'm interested in the Delta report that would be utilized to improve and enhance your techniques for better accuracy in between the censuses.
Ms. Browers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our population estimates that are produced each year in between the census are bound to that census count. So that is kind of the anchor on either side of our estimates each decade. So to the extent that we have an accurate count in the 2020 census, it's going to determine the accuracy of the count throughout the period, or throughout the year otherwise. We don't have another scientific, thorough way of counting everyone except for to rely on the Census Bureau every 10 years to do that for us. And so what we can do in between is estimate through building permits and through household sizes what a population estimate is for communities. But we don't have any other kind of mechanism for gathering that complete and full count except for through the decennial census.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my interpretation is you do a reconciliation, accepting the census numbers, but do not modify your assumptions and the calculations utilized in making your annual estimates. I would assume that there would be some patterns with the deltas of your last estimate versus the census that may lead to improved techniques and procedures to more accurately, so that the next census you'd be closer. And that's what I was looking at, is the delta.
Oh, okay.
It's more of a continuous improvement with a 10-year reset.
Representative Browers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to talk about that more with you and walk through the process that we do have, and we're always open to input for, how we could improve the process.
And Ms. Browers, guesstimate, how
what's going to be approximate number of our legislative districts? I mean, that's something we all care about. How much do we think that's going to grow number-wise? Do we have any just guesstimate on that? Or,
Mr. Chair, that's not a number I have in my head, but it's something I could go back and figure out.
Well, thank you. Representative Acomb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Brower. I have a quick question. You talked a little bit about some of the challenges in actual counting, and one of them being mobility. And I'm wondering if you have a tool or a mechanism to count our growing homeless population or people who are transient in their address.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
There's a specific operation that the Census Bureau does to count homeless people. If they are staying in a shelter on the night of the census, they're counted there. And so part of the work that we do is make sure that our social service providers to people experiencing homelessness are in contact with the Census Bureau, that they're aware of all the range of shelters and different housing situations that are out there. And that's something that we've already begun doing. For people who are truly outside on census day, there's an operation that goes out. Everything's called an operation. There's an operation that goes out to count people where they are. So whether it's on the Green Line or wherever, the Census Bureau then relies, again, on those same social service agencies to make sure that they know kind of where those places might be and that those folks know that, that people are coming and that it's a safe thing to do to answer their questions.
Thank you.
Representative Acomb. Members, any further questions? Well, thank you. And thank you for your presentation. Mm-hmm. And we can proceed with the next one. And good luck on your way.
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to introduce Wayne Wozlaski, our Director for Real Estate and Construction Services at the Department of Administration.
Thank you. And members, we'll hold the rest of our questions till the end of the presentation. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Wayne Wozlaski. I'm Senior Director for Real Estate and Construction Services. Pleased to be before you today. As the Commissioner mentioned, the state utilizes an enterprise real property system to manage our state buildings and their condition. This is crucial because Minnesota state government manages nearly 6,100 buildings on behalf of Minnesotans. Those buildings and facilities have a replacement value of $8.8 billion and are spread across 86 Minnesota counties. Red Lake County is the exclusion. The data that we have on the condition of our facility tells an important story. Historically, we have not invested enough through our asset preservation and capital investment bills to ensure our state facilities remain in excellent, good, or even average condition over time. There's no more perfect example than our state capitol. The state capitol is our most recognizable of state assets, and its historic restoration made it the single largest asset preservation project in state history. After years of underinvestment, the building had fallen into a state of disrepair. Ultimately, the legislature chose to invest considerable resources to restore the Capitol and to ensure the building would be in good shape for years to come. But the Capitol restoration project is small compared to total capital investment needed in public infrastructure statewide. And unfortunately, unlike the state capitol, most state facilities in need of asset preservation funds go unnoticed and unfunded. This next slide, as you can see from this slide, our buildings are getting older. Right now, the average state building is 41 years old. And 58% of state buildings are in stage 4 or 5 of their life cycle, meaning they are 30 years or older. In order to ensure these buildings are usable for years to come, they will need renewal or major renovation, which will likely cost an estimated 50% of the building replacement value. That will require a huge investment, and the current rate of capital bonding and asset preservation funding will not be sufficient. Specifically, 50% of replacement value of the 3,500 buildings that are over 30 years or older is $2.63 billion, and the total replacement value is $5.27 billion. On the next slide. The overall lack of investment means agency face difficult choices. Daily crisis in our buildings are prioritized over preventative maintenance. The problem, it is a simple reality that longer you delay addressing a problem, the worse the problem gets and more costly to fix. You can see from this chart that the average cost per square foot of deferred maintenance increases dramatically the poorer the condition of the facility. In fact, it costs approximately four times more to transition a building from poor to good condition and 12 times more to go from crisis to excellent condition than if you were to fund and perform regular preventive maintenance. For example, at Wyndham DNR office, delays due to inadequate funding have increased estimated costs by 30% to $1.5 million because of a leaking roof, siding, and windows. The building now has mold, rot, and structural damage. And some of you may recall that in 2016, the state paid $1.6 million to make repairs for the state office building that resulted from one water pipe failure impacting five floors of that building, of this building. So you can see from the video plane here of some of that video damage that was occurring. As the state of Minnesota continues to assess more of the building portfolio, the trend can suggest that buildings are getting worse rather than better and ultimately more expensive to repair. It would suggest that buildings are not being funded properly in order to keep up with the rate of degradation. Hopefully we can stop that trend because it is simply sound fiscal management to fund preventive maintenance through regular investments in asset preservation. Thank you, Chair members.
Stick around, we may have questions for you. I think the next is Marcus Grubbs.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Marcus Grubbs, and I work in the Office of Enterprise Sustainability as a planner. So the Office of Enterprise Sustainability facilitates a coordinated approach for the cabinet-level agencies to reduce resource use and meet six sustainability goals. Those goals are in reducing the use of fossil fuels in the fleet, reducing energy use, electricity, natural gas, and the like, and reducing water use. And also increasing rates of recycling and organics recycling, and increasing sustainable procurement practices. Our mission statement is shown on the slide here for your benefit, but we provide technical assistance to agencies in strategic planning and implementation. We help agencies and local governments get the tools they need to meet their sustainability goals through things like master contracts for electric vehicles and charging equipment, on-site photovoltaic design and build, organics collection by solid waste haulers, and others. Our work is directed by an interagency steering team. Historically, this team was chaired by Lieutenant Governor. The steering team is comprised of seven agency commissioners, four permanent members from admin, PCA, commerce, and DNR, and three rotating members. What you see in front of you is the inaugural annual report on sustainability. This is completed for the calendar year of 2017. It shows progress towards goals in the six focus areas, but you'll see that some progress has been made, even though 2017 is the first year of this effort. Some agencies were able to demonstrate and document efforts with sustained progress in the focus areas previous to 2017, and so they've been given credit for that work. An example of that is admin and others documenting how they've reduced and sustained energy use reductions. These efforts as a result of other initiatives were included in this scorecard. The annual report also shows nearly $26 million in avoided costs. These avoided costs are associated with the efforts that we just discussed, aligning with the goals that are shown here. While we are making great strides in GHG emissions reduction, energy use reduction, and sustainable procurement, we are challenged in fleet fossil fuel reduction, solid waste diversion to recycling organics, and reducing water use. My colleague Jordan Wente is going to share with you a sustainability reporting tool that provides accountability and transparency into state operations relative to these sustainability goals.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Jordan Wente, and I work for the Office of Enterprise Sustainability. Moving forward, we will present the enterprise's progress with the sustainability reporting tool, which is a cloud-based website of sorts. We created the sustainability reporting tool for two purposes. First, for agencies to plan, track, report, and analyze using their sustainability data. And secondly, to communicate the results of this data, progress towards goals, to the general public. What you're seeing up here on the slide is the external-facing landing page of the tool. This main website page lays out the six different focus areas. The tiles are interactive and follow the user throughout the website, thus inviting the user to explore each focus area in depth. To the top right of the pages, the About, Agency Scorecards, Resources, and Contact links remain throughout the site, providing different resources to the public user. Finally, at the bottom of the page is a real-time counter that tallies avoided costs due to conservation measures in energy, water, and fleet focus areas. Now, imagine, if you will, that the user clicks on the water focus area tile right there in the center of the page. The user is brought then to a dedicated focus area page, in this case for water. There's some text about the goal. There are descriptions of accomplishments, barriers, and best practices. As you'll notice, the focus area goal has 1.7% progress towards goal. This website, as a clarification, is not live yet. What you are seeing is simply a mock-up, an artistic rendition. The project is still in development. Scrolling down the page, we have different key performance indicators for each focus area. This is simply an example for water, where we have a breakdown of our water consumption by different use categories. Scrolling back up the page, I'm now going to just simulate that you want to click on the agency scorecards link up in the very top right of the page. This then brings you to a matrix, a table, of all the different focus areas and the different scores for all of our 24 cabinet-level agencies. You can sort the tables, you can compare agencies' progress side by side to see how agencies are performing. This is a totally new level of government transparency, and we believe that the public at large will be very interested to see how each agency is performing. Scrolling down, you will be able to then click on one of these links to explore specific data about that respective agency. So, for example, if you click on this DMA link, which is for the Department of Military Affairs, you would be brought then to the DMA-specific agency page. Here, then, you'll see performance on each of the focus area goals. And as you scroll down, you'll be able to see more text and narrative corresponding to that particular agency. While the framework of the page is hard-coded, meaning that the statistics, the data is all presented in a uniform way, agencies will have the ability to provide a custom narrative regarding their operations and the work that they are doing to meet these goals. And with that, that concludes this very basic simulation of what the site, we intend the site to work with and to be. We anticipate that the site will go live sometime in late spring, perhaps early summer. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Wente, what is your first name again? I've got Joel down here, and I thought I heard you said Jacob. Jordan? Okay, I want to correct my so we have it correct in the minutes.
Chair, Representative Jordan is my name.
Yeah. Thank you. Then our last presenter, Mr. Rausch. And like I said, we'll hold the questions till afterwards on the rest of them because they're still here. We can call them back down. Welcome to the committee, and please proceed with your testimony. State your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Roche. I'm the Division Director for the Office of Continuous Improvement here at the Department of Administration. The public sector is a service industry. Government improvement initiatives are focused on productivity and improving the experience of people interacting with government services. The private sector has long understood the value of operational excellence. I experienced this as an operations manager when I worked at General Electric under then CEO Jack Welch, as well as in leadership roles at Carlson Companies and Target Corporation. In the past 4.5 years in state service, my team and I have deployed continuous improvement tools to help agencies deliver maximum value to the public by advancing agency missions via increased efficiency, service accessibility, and cost avoidance. But the desire to improve government services has a long history in Minnesota. Some of you may remember back in 1913, Governor Adolf Eberhardt established the Economy and Efficiency Commission. Almost every governor since then has set up an initiative of some sort for improvement. Governor Pawlenty established the Minnesota Office of Continuous Improvement in 2007 at the Department of Administration as part of his Drive to Excellence initiative. Since 2007, the team has increased the continuous improvement capacity of more than 11,000 state and local staff in improvement tools and methodologies, engaged more than 3,700 state managers and supervisors to create a culture of continuous improvement with their teams, and facilitated more than 500 improvement projects with virtually every state agency and board. Our division serves all states individually and leads multi-agency improvement initiatives. So the approach we take is somewhat unique. We use a variety of problem-solving tools and methodologies, including Lean, Six Sigma, human-centered design, and the scientific method. We let the problem dictate the method instead of making the problem fit a strict methodology. Our three focus areas, as you see up on the slide, are culture, capacity, and results. Under culture, we do a biennial continuous improvement index survey. The survey and report, produced in 2016, 2018, and scheduled again for 2020, guides the improvement culture of all executive branch state agencies. All executive branch employees get to provide their views via this survey. When we get the agency-specific reports, we present them to the senior leadership teams and help guide them in their improvement culture. I also chair a continuous improvement advisory council, which is where most all state agencies have representation, and we meet regularly to share current improvement work, learn from each other, and advise on what works and what doesn't. Under capacity, we lead 4 enterprise-wide training courses: an introduction to continuous improvement, problem solving, process improvement measurement, and human-centered design in CI. The courses are free of charge, they're held quarterly and by demand, and they're open to all Minnesota-based federal, state, county, and local public sector staff. Under results, we implement problem-solving projects both at the Department of Administration and in other agencies. And we do this, is where we're a little unique as well. Our work is not event-based, it's project-based, which means that we talk about the specific problem that's going on, we implement those results, and then we stay with the project to see that the results are being sustained and move forward versus being just giving a group of recommendations and then moving on to the next project. So I'm going to go over a few of the projects that we've completed recently and then what we're currently working on. In the past 6 months, we completed a project with the Office of Higher Education. They have a student complaint process. We helped them work through that, and were able to reduce the time it took them to close and complete a student complaint by 44%. In the Department of Administration's Risk Management Group, under the Property and Casualty Renewal Process, we increased the automatic renewals for insurance policies from having no automatic renewals in 2017 to almost 40% in 2018. We expect that to increase again in 2019. Looking at our current portfolio of work, many of our projects are happening at the Department of Administration. With limited resources for improvement work, each project completed at our department can become a productivity multiplier, ensuring services for all Minnesotans and the public servants that provide them are efficient and effective. At the State Historic Preservation Office, we're helping them with their environmental Federal 106 review process. Our goals are to increase the response rate within 30 days to 100%, and increase the percentage of proposals submitted correctly by contractors by 10 percentage points. One of the enterprise-wide projects we'll work on is looking at early childhood program application process in response to an Office of the Legislative Auditor recommendation. We're convening a group with the Governor's Children's Cabinet, the Department of Human Services, the Department of Education, and the Help Me Grow initiative to work through that, and make sure that the parent caregiver experience in accessing services and financial assistance is both efficient and effective as possible without any law or statute changes. In the Department of Administration's Human Resources Group, we're looking at the hiring process. It's a very new project, and we're working at reducing the time it takes from when somebody needs to fill a position due to a retirement or somebody moving on somewhere else to the time that that person gets in their seat and starts working for the state. Obviously, the faster we can get somebody moving forward, the better. In the Department of Administration's Fleet Services area, we're looking at the vehicle ordering process. This is another new project that we're just kicking off, and our goal is to reduce the time it takes from when an agency wants a vehicle to the time they get that vehicle. And then later this spring, we also have projects scheduled with the Department of Corrections and another one with the Office of Higher Education. This work we do is hard, it's fun, and my mighty team of three people loves it because we get to make a difference in the lives of Minnesotans every day. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And now, questions I have here. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to the commissioner. You just had passed around to you a clip that I had printed from Care 11 Investigations. And what this relates to is the cooperative purchasing venture. And lest you think I always get in the weeds too much, one of the reasons I'm bringing this up is that it affected a lot of us. The city of Golden Valley was issued a refund, Medina, Minneapolis, Minnetonka, Northfield, Plymouth, Prior Lake, Northfield Hospital, South Lake, Minnetonka Police Department. So basically what happens here is obviously the purchasing venture is designed so that local law enforcement and other agencies can basically pretty much get a better deal on a car or a truck that they're going to use for their public service. Well, what happened was, if you look at page 4 of 18, back in 2015, St. Paul discovered that they were being overbilled and were refunded about $13,000, just under that big blank space. But the program itself never did any further investigation. Then in July of 17, on page 6, there was a worker charged at that car dealership, and then there was an audit done, you'll see on, I think, page 7 there. So I'm just running through this quickly, just to kind of set the stage. But then the audit came, and it was kind of left, and early in 18, you'll see right under those pictures of the checks, it says Care 11 was about to raise serious questions about whether the state missed hundreds of thousands of dollars again. So basically the first audit found some things, but then Care 11 kept on it, found some more things. So what I'm doing here is you can look through this thing, but my concern is that these local departments, of which many of our members have constituents, were overcharged. It came to light in 2015, but really wasn't, it had to take a television station to really dive into this thing. So my first question is, from the department's perspective, what went wrong? How could we have prevented this? And had the TV station not been there, I'm not so sure what would have happened.
Ms. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, thank you for the question. I think that the thing that we can't emphasize enough in the situation is that there was a criminal actor in the situation. The person who came to us with the concern was met by our team on multiple occasions and was not able to recreate the anomalies that he was seeing in the paperwork. And so we did do some initial reviews of the information that he brought forward, and again, we weren't able to find any of those irregularities. So I think that the thing that we've been pursuing at this point in time is working very closely with our internal auditor to ensure that all of the monies that were taken from the state by this bad actor have been returned to the different communities where that money actually rightfully belongs. The audit and the investigation went hand in hand. We also found some things that we have turned over, and we continue to work with the vendor to ensure that all of those monies are returned to the taxpayers and the citizens.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, though, initially this happened in 2015. And as I understand it, the first audit wasn't done until sometime in 2017, and then another follow-up audit was done in 2018 as a result of another television thing. That's my question. Is I'm glad that there has now been a settlement, but it seems to me that the settlement was more driven by the public being involved than the department itself having internal controls, which once this was discovered would have followed a path. And that's where my concern is here, is how could something like this happen when it was first reported but there was nothing in the department, no policies, procedures, whatever, that were going to get to the heart of it, starting in 2015.
Ms. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, since then we do have a new audit and tip procedure in place. We have a process that we go through if anyone comes forward and says that they're noticing any irregularities. We've hired additional staff to do compliance and contract management from that perspective as well. Additional policies is really what we've needed in order to ensure that this type of action doesn't happen again. And particularly with our system, this was a criminal actor, and so it was very difficult to perceive exactly what he was doing at that point in time.
So, Ms. Davis, when the city of St. Paul or anybody else around the state buys on the state contract, who's in charge of making sure that it's right? I mean, does the state deal with that, or is it the individual buyer that checks this out? It sounds like the individual buyer here found it and did some checking, and I'm quickly looking through. They're talking about a block heater that was missing, and which is minor, but that's they're being double charged for that. Is that the state's responsibility to do that, to look, make sure everyone that's purchased is not charged right, or is that the individual city, township, county, whatever?
Mr. Chair, although the Office of State Procurement negotiates the contract, once they make the purchase, the agreement becomes between the cooperative purchasing venture user and the vendor. And so it is up to the person who's making the purchase to ensure that they've received the goods that they ordered, to ensure that the pricing was correct, and to make sure that all of the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's what I'm getting at here, is I think there's a false sense of security when this thing is put together, because the contract is actually made, as I understand it, by Department of Administration. And there is a guaranteed profit, and as you read through this, you'll see that there's a guaranteed profit of $230 or whatever per unit. I guess my concern is that these departments are relying on the agency to enforce the contract that they have made. The individual cities did not make the contract. The contract is between the state and the automobile dealer, and what my concern was when I followed this, and I saw this on the news and I followed it, is that it happened in 2015, and our department has not got proper procedures and so forth to enforce the contract that they made. And that's where I'm going with this, is that had this not been for CARE 11, all of these cities that I just read off, and by the way, the total on this first set of things was $190,997. So this isn't small change, and that's why I'm going there. So I guess I know that there's other questions. I'm not going to belabor this, so I would ask if these things could be brought to us so that we can, may take a further investigation by us. But first of all, if the department could provide the timeline on all of the issues with Nelson's, whether, and that's the auto dealer, whether it was emails or other information.
And put on the record, no relation to me.
No relation to you. No, sir. But if all that could be provided to us, secondly, if they could provide the committee with copies of the two audits that admin performed on Nelson Auto, and Next, if they could provide the committee with the number of contracts administration oversees and the amount of money involved. And the reason I'm asking for those things is that I think that us as stewards of the public's money and protecting the cities that are using this and may have a little bit of a false sense of security, that they have to enforce the contract that the state is actually making, could have a little more confidence when they use the contract that indeed it's going to be taken care of properly.
And Ms. Davis, I guess if you can get that information to us, plus any information as far as where that customer relationship is, if it's between the individual and the dealership that are buying that, if it's the city, county, whatever, or if the state's responsible for monitoring that, that'd be good to have that information, and you can get that to us.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I'd be happy to do that. We did provide all of that information to the previous chair of the committee. We'll be happy to provide all of it again. Couple of things that I do want to point out is that we don't necessarily agree with all of the contract interpretations of the reporter who brought forward the story, so there are some disconnects there as far as what we actually accept as charge differences, and be happy to provide all of that additional information to you.
Thank you. Representative Olson, you had a question. I think it was on the same subject.
Yes. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. You touched on it a little bit. I mean, to Representative Vogel's point, this was, 2015. It was brought to the attention of the department. You've taken steps. You're a new commissioner, and welcome here, and congratulations. So in this, it does talk about the reforms underway. I mean, as best we can hope for is you can't go back and fix the past. You can only look to the future. And so, I see in here, and you've touched on it, that you instituted a new fraud investigation policy. You hired a compliance expert to review state contracts for abuses. Mm-hmm. So could you talk about just some of the forward-thinking things that you're doing? I think that's what we can ask for here, and that's what we'll be looking for.
Ms. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. Those two things are very important things that we did. We also did hire a third-party consultant who walked through our contracts and gave us some advice. There are some things that we will be doing differently as far as the structure of the contract going forward. But I think that, again, there were some things that were brought to light that were that we feel very valid and some things that we have to reject.
Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things that can be offline. One is noticing that a lot of the issues are revolving around roofs, having been on a school board and seen the variations of flat roofs and the continual costs. It'd be nice to understand if there's a feedback process from you do all this maintenance work, etc., so that your feedback to the people that do the designs for state buildings, if you made these changes, you would have a much more robust structure with less periodicity of costs for roof, floor, windows, etc. The other question is, when you're talking about the conservation, if you can give us an idea what the delta is in water between dry and wet years, because I know it's You broke it out to outdoor, but on to the CI continuous improvement. Then I also have concerns about what Representative Vogel brought up and the competency in some of the reviewing. But my concerns, I mean, I've worked in a site that received a Malcolm Baldrige Award. When I was on a school board, we were pursuing Malcolm Baldrige improvements and techniques, but we also were looking at using the aggregate purchase contracts that the state had, and when they built it up for IT and we analyzed it, my district has a lot of people that work for IBM and we're very tech savvy, and we noticed that the contracts when drawn up had a good initial price, but the normal options and things that would be needed by a school district weren't included, and they were huge up charges. And I think if you're going to do aggregate purchasing, and I've you know, been involved in that in the business world. You look at what are the things that you're going to need. Mm-hmm. That includes, we're Minnesota, plugging your engine block into heat is not an unusual thing. So there should be a feedback in your continuous improvement process so that when you do your negotiations, you actually make it for what a reasonable full equipped vehicle or computer system and all the components had. And I'm wondering if you have that process of where you get that feedback and you're improving it, because it sounds as if stretching over years, and I'm assuming that you weren't there during the whole period, but if you are truly have a continuous improvement process, those improvements should be almost automatic, and I'd like some confidence that and feedback as to, you know, that happens in the contracting portion of your business.
Ms. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, thank you for the feedback. We can definitely take that back. I do know that there are some contracts that are built in that way. Certainly all the contracts are not one size fits all. They're being used by cities, counties, school districts, lots of different entities, 1,300 different entities across the state have access to these contracts, and so there is not a one size fits all approach. Some of our vehicles contracts are managed in exactly the way that you described. We say these are the typical things that a State Patrol vehicle would like to have, and we build the vehicles in that way. So we have done that in some instances, and in others we have not.
Representative Kwan. If you have a shorter question.
The basic intent is you're providing a service across the entire state. You make a big thing that you have continuous improvement. The key part to continuous improvement is feedback from your customers. And when I was at the school board, I didn't seem as if that was there. Now, that's been a few years, but it'd be nice to maybe have to the committee, this is our process for the feedback and continuous. So we have a vision of it as opposed to just a few fancy slides.
Thank you. I think she heard you. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions are for Mr. Krebs and Mr. Wozlowski. For Mr. Krebs, we had the Enterprise Core Card here with the greenhouse gas progress to goal, and looks like we're at 56% of our way towards the 2025 goal. I'm wondering if we're on track to meet our 2025 goal, and also what tools you have to work with the various agencies to try to make sure we're achieving it.
Mr. Wozlowski, or Mr.
Grubbs.
Mr. Grubbs, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, thank you for the question. We think we're on target to hit the 2025 goal of 30% reduction. Where I give pause in saying that we're on target is that a lot of really great work has been done by agencies already, particularly in the way of energy savings, and including admin and others, DOT, DNR, DMA, and Met Council that have done a lot of work there. And so it starts becoming, how do you squeeze more and more energy savings out of those when you've done a lot already? So I'm cautiously optimistic. We are also providing the agencies and local governments with tools to reduce their GHG emissions through things like renewable energy. So I mentioned a contract for on-site solar, and we're also working on exploring other things and developing some more tools, including maybe some ground source heat pump or preheating air with solar.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Second question is on our fleet purchases. The image in the slide presentation has a Chevy Bolt, which is a great car. It's the one I drive. And they right now, electric vehicles have a cheaper overall cost of maintenance and operation than gas vehicles. Curious what our progress has been towards moving our fleet to electric and what you expect going forward.
Mr. Grubb.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Long. So we have been effectively over the last 2 years doubling our number of EVs and PHEVs, plug-in hybrid electrics, and those are still very few. I think as of October 8th, we had 67 electrics and plug-in hybrid electrics. We have, along with that, on the Capitol complex, 74 electric vehicle chargers, and then there are also electric vehicle chargers at some locations. For example, the DNR has some, MPCA, Met Council. And we are working on pushing that even further. I think I'm optimistic that we'll be at 20% electric vehicles by 2027 if things go well. There are some barriers to EVs. For example, manufacturers don't like to sell their vehicles here, or they're not eager to, because they view that this is a less mature market than maybe the West Coast or East Coast states. Our former director, Commissioner Herkey, now Commissioner Herkey, worked with Chevy directly to get a shipment of Bolts. And we're exploring doing that with other models that are out there now.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my final question is for Mr. Wozlowski. When we're talking about building energy efficiency and you're looking to do some of these large-scale renovations, are we renovating to SB 2030 standards for the administration buildings?
Mr. Chair, Representative, for bond-funded projects, we're required to meet that standard. So all bond-funded projects, either new construction or major renovations, require to meet both our sustainable building guidelines, the B3 guidelines, and SB 2030 is part of those guidelines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there buildings that we are not renovating to SB 2030, or is it pretty much that all buildings are bond funded?
Mr. Wozlowski.
Well, Mr. Chair, as we get funding to do major renovations, then it is required. Most of our projects are funded with bond funds, so it is we're meeting that standard, even on projects where there may be some cash dollars. We're looking to meet the B3 and SB 2030 standards. We're also, as Marcus has indicated, we're looking to incorporate renewable energy as we can as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, now you want to ask a question to Mr. Wozlowski also.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Wozlowski. Usually you and I see each other with a hard hat and a construction vest on. Just a couple questions with regard to the aging buildings and systems, and principally with regard to the major buildings in the Capitol Mall. We're in the state office building, and I know that, you know, relevant to the video that we're all very familiar with and the water hazards. In 2016, you made an observation that to renovate the state office building was $12 million for design and $110 million for construction. In 2018, that price tag went up to $24 million for design and $222 million for construction renovation. There's a kind of a scary trend line that might be occurring here, and I'm just wondering if you've made any or could make any prognostications in terms of what we're looking at, particularly in light of what happened with the water damage to this building.
Mr. Wozlowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, appreciate the question. And I would just comment, is that pipe break in 2016, we've probably had five or six pipe breaks in both correctional facilities, veterans' homes in the last month. So we're talking about this aging building population. And obviously, we all know it's cheaper to fix the buildings before the pipe breaks. So we are dealing with and that's where we can have a conversation on CAPR funding, our emergency funds over the last couple of years that have been expended on a very rapid basis to deal with these situations. Obviously, inflation is a huge factor that plays as we're delaying, as projects get delayed, as funding gets delayed. what you can buy in 2016 and then what you can buy in 21 with that same dollar, it just inflation eats away, has a significant impact. But it's also the scope of work. As things get older, more things need to be replaced, more things need to be addressed. And one of the things that was different between those two numbers is one was just a pure asset preservation. Let's fix the pipes. Let's take care of the roof. Let's do the windows. But it didn't address how do you make the building work better for members, for visitors, for the public in the hearing room. So that's the main one. The other than inflation, that's probably the main factor that really this building needs a comprehensive approach to its restoration and renovation. It constructed originally in 1932, so it's past stage five. It's in that life cycle of a building. You're just going to continue. We don't, you try to forecast. Chris Given, our facility director, as we got into cold weather, we actually have a device that they use to go to sprinkler heads, and they go around and try to get ahead of where do we think we have a frozen pipe. But you can only chase that so much. You only have so much staff time to do that. Obviously, they have other responsibilities that they're doing. In this case, I think Mr. Given mentioned they caught five or six different sprinkler heads that were frozen. They were able to deal with it before it broke. But those are the kind of things that if you get ahead on a more comprehensive approach, you're looking at your heating systems, you're looking at your building envelope, you have a better chance of avoiding some of these costly interruptions to our facilities.
And it's my understanding that the valve that broke that caused the leak here was one that had already been replaced, so it was a newer valve. It wasn't one of the old valves.
Mr. Chair, in this case, that was true.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for Mr. Wozlowski, I know that there has been an eye towards the property to the west with the Sears property, and I know that the bankruptcy court has now enjoined with a new owner, so I'm not sure what the disposition is of the Sears building or the property itself, if they're going to keep it or renovate it. I know that there's new ownership coming about because of that, but it is inclusive of the Capital Mall complex. And just in light of parking, particularly for the people that use in the Department of Administration utilizing spaces over there, I'm just wondering if there's a kind of a long-term plan adjoining to that property and in conversations with the ownership. Where do we stand on that?
Mr. Wozlowski.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sure the Commissioner is going to want to jump into this as well. Obviously, it's the most significant property on the campus within the Capitol area. If you even look out, if you have a time horizon of 30, 40, 50 years, you really look at, this is a key opportunity and obviously also a significant challenge related to the parking that we currently lease at that facility. They did a while back, they had a development arm, Seritage, and then they spun that group off as a separate from the Sears. So and obviously this store itself is closed, but so there was a lease arrangement between that new ownership group holding company and the Sears Corporation. We're obviously closely following that. There's a couple of points, and the Commissioner may want to weigh in on this. One is part of what we've been advocating for a number of years is for a long-term strategic plan related to facilities. It's been a long time since we've looked at the analysis between owning a facility and what's that cost over a 30, 40-year period and comparing that to leasing facilities. And so funding to do a strategic plan would provide us better information for all decision makers to make a good, sound real estate decisions on what our strategy is. But we certainly see that right now with existing authority that the commissioner has, there's a potential for that in having conversation with state agencies about you know, do we issue an, some type of solicitation around leasing to see what type of development proposals could come in, and that, you know, not only the Sears site, there's a lot of opportunities. If you're following development in St. Paul, you have the new soccer stadium. There's lots of development opportunities over in that location. There's obviously the Ford plant site, and watching what's happening there. There's just there's the project downtown at the Ramsey County site. There's obviously advantages to locating on the campus, and so the, you know, obviously the Sears site is very attractive. But just from a competitive standpoint, if you put out an RFP on the street, it'd be an interesting time to see what kind of response that's come back in.
Representative Hertas. And we're going to go a little bit late, but at 25-2, we're going to adjourn no matter how many questions people have on the list. So
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this conversation has been an interesting one. I've had a number of personal experiences in my lifetime with regard to government contracting, government procurement, whether I was the bidder or whether functioning as mayor, we were purchasing. And one of my observations has been with regard to procurement is these contracts are written so tightly that there are specific vendors in mind. It's very clear that the pool of people in competing to provide the product is rather limited. And I think that's a big flaw, because your mission and your service is to provide functionality of a product for these various departments. Case in point, we had with joint powers agreement for fire service amongst three communities, the joint powers fire department wanted a specific little off-road vehicle to go and put out a brush fire. And this vehicle consisted of the type of vehicle you would buy at Cabela's for $25,000. And it had a stretcher to extract an individual. It had a fiberglass water tank and a hose reel. $250,000. And when queried why, well, it has to have this specification on it. Well, what you have are contracts that are written that only one or two vendors have that type of horn that fit that vehicle or that arrangement of flashing lights. And so my question to you is, in the real mission that you're there to do is to serve the, be a fiduciary in the best you can with regard to the taxpayer's dollar, you ought to provide contracts that have specification but permit or equal. Allow more vendors to bid on these projects and explain why their alternative is comparable, whether it's the specification on the tires or whether it's the color of the paint or the grade of the stainless steel on the fire truck. You know, the stainless steel on the fire truck doesn't put out the fire. You know, the wheels and the machine that gets it there do. So that would be my suggestion. I don't know if you have any ideas as new commissioners about this issue, but it's a real problem. The public's getting hosed on this type of equipment. I mean, it is outrageous the amount of money that's being paid for some of these vehicles.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the feedback. We balance a lot of priorities as we're negotiating contracts. We are trying to ensure that there's open competition on every contract that goes up for bid. Typically, the specifications are not so unwieldy that they're not able to be met by multiple vendors. That's the way that we keep the prices competitive and low. But I do appreciate the feedback, and I will take that back to the team.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to combine two questions. One is the move of the Preservation Office to the Department of Administration was rather controversial, so it would be nice to know how that move has been successful or how that has been working. And then also we have the Ford building across the way, and what is the status of that building?
Commissioner or whoever.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will start with the question on SHPO first and say that, as you noted, the department or the division moved to the department in March of last year. The biggest issue was underinvestment in technology for that particular division, and so we've been working on a new project management portal that will allow greater public access. We've got some continuous improvement projects that are going on with the office, working on the customer service platform for the office as well. We're starting to see a lot of improvement in the office and the way that the service is being delivered. And finally, we're doing a lot more outreach and education with stakeholders so that they understand the office, how it works, but more importantly, how we can hear from them the ways they'd like to see us continuously improve. On the second question about the Ford Building, the Ford Building is an interesting piece of property. It actually is a very valuable piece of property. It's something that, again, as Mr. Wozlowski noted in a strategic plan, we would love to see something happen with that piece of property because of its outstanding location. We do owe quite a bit of money on the building because of maintaining it. There's a lot of exterior portions of the building that are in disrepair, and so we continue to maintain it for safety reasons. And so if there were ever an opportunity for us to replace that building with a building that could be utilized in a different way, that would be an opportunity, as we also look again at the overall redevelopment of the Sears site and the location between here and there. It's something that we would be willing to discuss.
Representative Mason.
Thank you. I guess I'm looking at the Ford Building as being a fairly historic building, so I'm not too excited about you taking it down. And I do understand the property location, but I mean it is an attractive building. It is a historic building, so that means nothing's going forward with getting the building up to code.
And Commissioner, as a person that worked most of my life in construction and actually did have to do a remodeling project on a historic building that we couldn't touch the outside, it's much more expensive to have to repair those and bring them up to current standards than it is to tear it down and build a new one. But we also want to preserve our buildings that we have that have historic value.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. Just an option and one opportunity, just noting that as an observation, it is a very valuable piece of property and the building is obviously not being used to its full capacity at this point.
Thank you.
Members. Thank you, members. And as Commissioner, you see we have an inquisitive bunch here, and thank you for your time and your answers.
I would have not wanted to spend Valentine's Day anywhere else. Thank you.
And this meeting's adjourned.